Tell the people what you're here for.
Bring everything out closer to the people.
Basic. We got to stop it, brother. Let's get together and unify.
An oppressed person will fight back.
2-4 baby.
Radio Basics.
And there's always a message involved.
CHRY 105.5 Radio Basics. Welcome back. It's, you know, Monday night, March something, 22nd, I think. And we got a big show. We're gonna cover recent developments in the case of Alwi Al Nadir. And if you have been listening to Radio Basics or involved in Basics community organizing, somehow you're probably familiar with this case. This was a very controversial case of a resident of Regent Park was killed with impunity by Toronto police, and it's been a swarm of controversy around his case ever since. And we're going to have a organizer from Justice for Alwi come through and talk a bit about his case, what's happened since, and today the reason we're covering it is because today the coroner's inquest began in the city of Toronto. And we're going to have organizer Alok come through, and he's going to talk a bit about it. So that's going to take up the bulk of our show, the local news section. Right now, though, I want to just talk a bit about international news and a big development. It depends on what side you're on, if it's good or bad. But the Obama's healthcare bill in some form passed today. Got through the House of Representatives, that was split basically right down party lines, with, Democrats on one side and Republicans on the other. And so this is going to extend healthcare coverage to a lot of people and not allow health insurance corporations to prevent you from getting coverage if you have a pre-existing condition. And this was one of the main things. And if you've seen Michael Moore's movie Sicko, you'll know what this is about. The bulk of that movie is not about people, the 35 million people that aren't covered under healthcare, that simply cannot get health insurance in the United States, but people that do have health insurance and that are consistently denied coverage for whatever reason. And I want to read, just before the break, I want to read an article that I found online by a doctor and a medical historian, Jacob Apel. This is called Health, in quotes, Insurance, a Criminal Enterprise. Federal lawmakers have squandered much of the autumn debating how best to provide private health insurance to approximately 50 million uninsured Americans. Guaranteeing health care for these individuals is certainly a moral imperative. However, relying on private insurers to serve these individuals is about as prudent as hiring a gang of criminals convicted of sexual assault to run a national child care program. Anyone who has worked as a health care provider long enough has been paying attention eventually comes to recognize private health insurance is a large-scale criminal endeavor, part Ponzi scheme, part extortion racket, that consistently exploits patients at their most vulnerable moments. In short, private health insurance is a sort of predatory enterprise, like paying payday lending and loan sharking, that should be criminalized. Health insurance, as the late historian Edward Bessler pointed out in one of his articles, is a misnomer. The principle behind traditional insurance is a distribution of risk. For example, the odds of my house burning down are quite low. The odds of another home burning down in my community is similarly low. However, the odds of some home in our community burning down is probably pretty high. So we all pay into a reserve fund, or fire insurance. and whoever suffers the misfortune of having a home burning collects the pot. This pooling of risk is a staple of most, you know, economics and insurance classes that you'll take. However, health, quote, insurance, and whenever I say insurance, it's in quotes, does not follow this model. Because over the course of time, nearly all of us will suffer a bodily ill that causes us to draw funds from the collective till. So what we are doing by paying for private insurance is having a third party manage our healthcare dollars for us until we're ready to use them. In return, this third party banks the interest and skims a profit off the top, employing an army of paper-pushing middlemen to manage our contribution. The very act of calling healthcare middlemen insurers buys into a false belief that these companies are protecting us against the rare occurrences, rather than simply serving as money managers of our healthcare dollars. Yet once consumers view these corporations merely as money managers, few sane people would ever invest at interest rates of zero for such low payouts in return. The system I have described would be cause enough for the government to ban private insurance and replace it with publicly run plan. Unfortunately, the economic structure of America is not nearly as nefarious in theory as it is in practice. Most people in this country who do have private health insurance are happy with their coverage until they actually attempt to use it. Once they face a medical emergency, however, they discover that the unspoken policy of many insurers is to deny as many claims as possible, often on legally and medically implausible grounds, until the patient or his family give up. Multiple calls, usually including direct intervention from a physician, may pressure an insurance company into changing their ruling, but the critically ill often lack the time and emotional energy to wage such battles. So I fear that in the drive to assure universal health care coverage, policymakers and the general public have largely missed the point. Having health insurance does not do you any good if the insurance does not cover an illness or injury. Opponents of national healthcare industry plans often lambaste the straw man of having public officials determine what procedures will be available to the sick and dying. This, you know, I think is best exemplified in Ronald Reagan's, record that he released on the dangers of socialized medicine. In contrast, they would have us believe that those determinations are presently made by individual doctors serving the needs of patients. As a physician, I can assure them that those directions are actually rendered by low-level employees at large healthcare conglomerates. None of these people have medical degrees or even a basic understanding of human biology. Their sole job in the world is to deny coverage until pressured into doing otherwise. Alas, the only practical recourse that many patients have is to sue. After navigating a hoop of intermediate remedies such as arbitration and depending on their state and contract. This is about as realistic as telling the passengers aboard the Titanic that they have the right to sue for more lifeboats. The reality is that cancer victims in need of expensive chemotherapy and psychotic patients desperate for inpatient medical health services cannot be expected to lodge lengthy and complex legal challenges against their so-called insurers. Given the choice between an American public servant determining my coverage or a private box-checking lackey working out of outsourced shells in different countries, I'd side with the shortcomings of the American bureaucracy any day. So would most Americans. That's why Medicare remains so popular today. From an ethical point of view, the real question is not whether there should be a public option, but whether there should even be a private option. Once a public system of genuine universal healthcare coverage is established, our society will have to decide whether wealthy individuals will be allowed to use their own personal funds to buy additional care that is not provided by the government. Is buying extra chemotherapy or life support a human right? Or does it transcend a moral boundary, like buying a cornea on the black market? This will prove a difficult ethical dilemma. The government certainly has the authority to ban out-of-pocket supplemental care, as much as it prevents private companies from delivering first-class mail, and could prohibit the establishment of a private, quote, social security system. Whether the state should exercise such power is another matter. While most reasonable, progressive people might roughly agree on what ought to constitute the floor of healthcare coverage, any effort to limit costs by creating a, quote, ceiling will likely generate controversy. Yet once a national healthcare system emerges and the public option swallows up the private healthcare, it's likely to be the moral conundrum that we face. I have little doubt that the day will soon arrive when the CEOs of health insurers are dragged before Congress to face some sort of interrogation at which war profiteers were grilled by the Truman Committee in the 1940s, and to which the Waxman hearings subjected Big Tobacco in the 1990s. When that day arrives, I do hope Congress permits the victims of falsely denied claims and calculating dithering to testify against them. During a recent encounter at my hospital, upon learning that a suffering patient's need for essential treatments would be denied by the insurer, a man's social worker informed me that this patient had, quote, bad insurance. I'd heard this line one too many times, so I asked, what would constitute good insurance? My colleague replied, staying healthy. That may be a bitter medicine, but it is a horrific truth. All private insurance plans fall short when it comes to covering necessary care. To put it bluntly, private health insurers sell an enormous sour lemon, a product that does not and cannot work. The best solution might be to criminalize such enterprises entirely. And I think that sort of sums up, you know, the sentiments against, you know, private health care. Now, Obama's legislation did not include a government option or, you know, single payer or universal coverage. It just sort of extended benefits to already uninsured people, a range of other things, and as well prevented companies from disallowing insurance coverage for a pre-existing condition. You know, I'd like to hear your thoughts. If you think this is a good development or a bad development, you can call the station at 416-736-5656. Right now, we're going to go to commercial break. And when we come back, we're going to have Alok Premji talk about the case of Alwi Al Nadir. So stay tuned. CHRY 105.5 Radio Basics. CHRY 105.5 Radio Basics. We're back. So right now, we're going to continue our coverage of the case of Alwi Al Nadir. And on the line, I've got, you know, a good friend of mine and an organizer for the Justice for Alwi campaign, Alok, and he's going to, you know, explain the case and what's the development in Toronto and why this is important to the community of Toronto. So, Alok, you with us?
Yeah, I'm here, man.
Hey, what's going on? Thanks a lot for being here, man.
Thank you for having me on your show. It's always a pleasure doing Radio Basics.
All right. Okay, Alok, so can you briefly explain who Alwi Al Nadir was and what happened to him?
Yeah, okay. Well, Alwi Al Nadir was a young high school student. He attended Central Tech in the downtown core. He worked part-time at the old Spaghetti House. You know, he was a lovable boy. He was doing well in school. He aspired to be an engineer. And, his significance is that on Halloween night 2007, Alwi was shot and killed by Toronto police in Riverdale Park. He was unarmed, mm-hmm. and he was shot and killed by a Toronto police officer. So the manner in which he was shot to death screamed execution style.
Can you elaborate?
Well, he was essentially shot in the back, mm-hmm. While he was unarmed, and, there was no justification for that shooting.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of the investigation, instead of investigating the shooting with transparency, the SIU, which is the Special Investigations Unit, which is the provincial body that's supposed to independently investigate police violence, basically whitewashed the crime and exonerated the officers involved. So the report released by the SIU contradicted the information given to the family as well as the other reports on Alwi's killing, such as media reports, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. So, Alok, why do you think that Alwi's legacy is so important, and why does it serve the basis for the Justice for Alwi campaign?
Well, police violence is unfortunately a daily reality in many of Toronto's poorest neighborhoods, mm-hmm. and across North America and across the world.
Right.
And officers are almost never held accountable for their excessive force and brutalization. So the corporate media, the judicial system, and the investigation processes are always labeling the victims of police brutality as criminals, when the real criminals, those who are supposed to be protecting us, continuously get away with murder.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are countless cases of police brutality in our city, or as the police call, police misconduct, or as we call it, police brutality,
mm-hmm.
In our city. But the province does not have the internal mechanisms to address these to address police brutality, which is why police get away with murder with impunity. Mm-hmm. And here's an interesting fact. Since 2003, the SIU has cleared police of wrongdoing in 32 of 32 fatal shooting cases.
Wow, 100%. They get off.
Yeah, man.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, the Justice for All We campaign was created and it was, well, essentially was born out of community concerns over police brutality, namely after All We All the Deer.
Right.
But out of this tragedy, All We's family and his friends and other local community organizers saw the need to get organized to put an end to the siege on our communities. Mm-hmm. So through that, we created the Justice for All We campaign against police brutality.
Mm-hmm. So, Alok, since then, since the shooting and the formation of Justice for Owie, and in between the coroner's inquest today, sort of what developed and how did this movement grow?
Essentially, what I said, I mean, families and the local community organizers saw the need. This is to get organized because
right.
it was becoming much more rampant in mm-hmm. the last, I would say, 5 years. And it was the conditions of police, like the toxic relationship between police and, you know, low-income marginalized communities were intensifying to the point as they were in the late 80s, early 90s, you know,
right.
which gave birth to the Black Action Defense Committee,
mm-hmm.
you know, which after the death of Buddy Evans and Albert Johnson and Lester Donaldson sparked and the infamous Rodney King trial
mm-hmm.
sparked riots in Los Angeles, but not only Los Angeles, but the killing of Lester Donaldson and the exoneration of police officers in those three particular cases led to the Yonge Street, I would say, not riots, but cries for justice, you know, and that gave birth to the SIU because the province realized that they, you know, there was civilian outlash and resistance
mm-hmm.
To police continually getting away with murder.
Right.
So, I mean, in respect to your question, what has developed in between the shooting and the coroner's inquest that began today was, mobilization of our communities, and particularly youth and young mothers who, you know, experience police raids, police harassment. Police brutality is not just limited to a cop shooting and killing somebody. But that violence exists in the, you know, why a policeman asking what's your name, what's in your pocket, patrolling,
yeah.
Profiling, pulling somebody over. I mean, this is violence in every which way.
Right. Right. So, look, what is a coroner's inquest and what happened today in court?
Okay, well, a coroner's inquest is basically it's a non-criminal investigation that doesn't bring anybody to justice, nor does it hold anybody accountable or culpable for a crime.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically jurors are able to put forward recommendations if it is determined that, in this case, the cops did something wrong to prevent a similar death like this occurring in the future. So, In this case, the recommendations will pertain to adjustments or changes in policy procedures of the police. In a few weeks ago, Dwayne Christian had their coroner's inquest. He was a 15-year-old boy shot and killed by Toronto police in 2006.
Mm-hmm.
And the recommendations that were put forth were that the police had to use better discretion, had to be educated better to use better discretion in the use of guns. So there are a lot of explicit guidelines within the coroner's inquest that jurors, lawyers involved for both parties have to abide by, and that means that no historical significance can be brought into as evidence. So they can only refer to the evidence from the specific case. Nobody can be held, nobody can be blamed. So the officers can't be said, well, you know, you're at fault here, and if there's any evidence that points in that direction,
yep.
or any suggests anything like that, that will be dismissed.
Mm-hmm.
So its purpose is to prevent deaths like this from occurring in the future.
Mm-hmm. What do you think the outcome, or what do you hope the outcome? What's the best case scenario, in other words, that can come out of this this inquest?
I don't know. I mean, what's important to realize here is that this inquest will be a time when the Toronto Police Force will attempt and have already attempted to further criminalize Owie.
Mm-hmm.
They want to tarnish his memory and justify the killing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for example, today it was the beginning of was the first day of the of Owie's inquest, and the coroner's counsel, which is the lawyer representing the coroner's office, is stated to be a median that is not in position of the police nor in position of the family
mm-hmm.
of Owie, but is a representative of the community and the public's interest. However, the opening statements of that coroner's counsel, her name is Rebecca Edwards.
Right.
It was as if she was a representation of the police, and that was her bias, because she first and foremost gave a description of Owie, and the only description she gave of Owie was how he has some criminal charges that were in the past as a juvenile were in his file, that he did 22 hours of community service because of that, and that as she stated in her own words, Owie and the other fellow that Owie was with that night engaged in risky and dangerous business, which led to the unfortunate series of events that forced police to assert violence. And she labeled that there were some other witnesses in the courtroom that day that were going to testify or they were on the witness stand. And she labeled them as being victimized by Owie. So immediately, like, she is not taking a position, an unbiased position here, or
mm-hmm.
or even willing to be a representative of the community and look at this objectively. She already had a subjective perspective in
right.
terms of criminality.
Mm-hmm.
So we already know the design of, you know, and the inner workings of the coroner's inquest. I mean, they work hand-in-hand with the police and the state.
Mm-hmm. So your perspective is that the inquest itself is already biased, and
the structure of the inquest is
mm-hmm.
Biased itself, but that is not to say that, you know, good recommendations can come out of this. I mean, because evidence itself will no matter how much, you know, the police and their lawyers want to paint and manipulate that evidence, as it was proven today, it's very hard for them to do that, because there was a lot of honesty from the witnesses that were on stand
mm-hmm.
that the jurors saw right through.
Right.
And they saw that, all right, there was a lot of problematics with the police report in mm-hmm. terms of the case. It was looking good today in terms of what the jury heard. And the way they were forming their mentality around this case.
Mm-hmm.
So
can you elaborate on that exactly?
Well, okay, I can give you exact. I mean, the SIU report in the beginning was very inconsistent, and one of the reports, I think, which is what they stuck with,
mm-hmm.
is that Owie was struggling with the officer trying to reach for the gun of this officer. And when I saw the officer today, just to give a physical description, he was a good 6'3", 6'4", 250, 260 pounds. Now, big, burly man.
Yep.
And when you look at Owie is no more than 5'6", 5'7", or 5'5". And, you know, small frame, very, very small body.
Mm-hmm.
So for him to like, wrestle with this man and try to reach for the gun is very unlikely.
Yeah.
And that wasn't the case, because the witness that were on stand today, you know, testified that there was no struggle, that the officers were you know, not provoked in any sort of way, that which it, and they just fired their gun, without being attacked. So, which, and the police lawyer was trying to, like, get both witnesses, as, and I, it seemed very well that those witnesses were coached prior by these police lawyers, who were the ones who selected them. You know, they were the ones who picked the list of witnesses. So naturally, they did have influence in speaking with these witnesses. And so they did seem pre-versed or coached or whatever you want to say prior to this inquest. And even then, the jurors found a lot of discrepancy and got information that clearly said that there was no scuffle, there was no skirmish with the officer and the three youth that were involved.
Right. Alok, stepping back a bit, you know, away from this case, and then and just thinking about, you know, police in general and the relationship to the state. You know, someone once put it that basically a state is an entity that has a monopoly on violence. Right, so a government is like the only entity that legally can use violence for its own purposes. Now, what do you think is the ramifications of having the state investigating, you know, its own violent force, the police, and how far do you think these investigations can go?
Like I said, there's the SIU. Which is that body. Let me give a brief description of the SIU and the makeup of that body. It's supposed to be a civilian agency monitoring police violence and investigating police violence. However, the officers, like the primary officers that make up this SIU, and the reason why I say officers is because a large majority of the SIU are retired police officers, with very few representations of the direct communities that are policed.
Right.
And those being, you know, there's no denying the fact that they're low-income, marginalized, or whatever the mainstream media's and the police's classification for them, the high-prioritized neighborhoods. You know, that labeling or whatever. Those are the neighborhoods that are policed heavily, but there aren't any representations of community members on this SIU that reflect that community. So the ramifications of having the state investigate the state, I mean, that clearly suggests that there aren't the mechanisms to hold the state accountable.
Right. Right, because, you know, it seems to me that if a state has a monopoly on violence, it can't engage in something that's going to delegitimate itself.
Exactly.
So the state is not going to, have a body that's going to make, you know, police practices seem illegitimate to people.
If it
increasingly comes out, you know, like, take the 32 cases, if, you know, police are found, you know, guilty of some crime, and, you know, 12, even 10, you know, people are really going to look at that and start to rethink, you know, the role of police in the communities.
I mean, and look at, when you look at the police budget, the Toronto police budget, that's, you know, as of last year was almost $900 million, I mean, $896 million to be exact, and they got a 4% increase in this year, annual increase. I mean, so we're looking at a police budget ballooning over $1 billion.
Yeah.
I mean, so if the state is investing so much money, and that money is our taxpaying money, you know, there is a reason for them to place the police services board on a pedestal,
right,
and suggest that they are protecting and serving, you know, the community's best interests.
Right, and yeah, and I mean, during the recent crisis, the financial crisis, when budgets are being cut, you know, all sort of welfare services and state austerity measures, you know, the police budget seems the only one that isn't being touched, right?
Oh, no.
and perhaps military. So, Alok, then what would be, say, your recommendations for, would it be, you know, a strictly civilian body? Would people just simply have to organize their own body to...
My friend, that's a very complex question.
Right.
I really don't have an answer for you there.
Mm-hmm.
But where we can begin is accountability.
Right.
I mean, transparent accountability here.
Yeah.
Essentially, it would make sense if you're going to have a civilian agency that monitors police wrongdoing,
mm-hmm.
then it should be made by the communities itself, and in this case, if we're looking at restructuring it now, then we got to look at the communities that are represented in the jails.
Mm-hmm.
So you look at the makeup of our jail, our prison system. Where are these bodies coming from?
Mm-hmm.
So in that case, then we got to have people from those communities, primarily people from those communities. That make up these this civilian agency that monitors the policing.
Right. And I mean, that was one of the main points of the Black Panther Party was that, these people that are being, thrown in jail were not subject to a trial by their peers, which is, a constitutional language, that you
are
subject to a jury of your peers. And it would make sense for the community to, have the inputs and to judge the character of somebody who committed a crime in their community, not say somebody, from the other side of Canada or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It was also just one point. Reading in the Toronto Star an article by Peter Small who says the police continuously gauge in these secret background checks on potential jurors.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning that, if this juror doesn't look like it'd be a favorable outcome from the police. And, I mean, the Toronto Star and even the National Post has spoken out against this, which is really saying something, if the
mm-hmm.
National Post is. That, there's a secret background checks that the OPP is engaging in. That's highly illegal. But, and it should result in a mistrial at least, but, a lot of times it just goes under the radar.
Oh, naturally.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, Alok, I think, we got to go to a commercial break, but thanks a lot. Before we go, can you explain to people how they can get involved or if they can take part in the inquest as it's continuing?
Oh, yes. Well, the inquest began today,
mm-hmm.
and it's at the address is the coroner's office,
yep.
coroner's court's office, which is 15 Grosvenor Road.
Right.
And that is on Yonge Street, just two blocks north of College Street.
Okay.
That's actually between Bay and Yonge, two blocks north of College.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be running from at least this week.
Mm-hmm.
Tomorrow, Thursday, and Friday are the witnesses. And then next week, again, it'll go on next week. So it runs for about 2 weeks to 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And it's from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
And it's open to the public. So, all the support would be loved by the family.
Right.
His family will be present at the inquest and needs as much support as they can get.
Mm-hmm.
So, if you do have the time, please come and share, that type of support. It would work well with giving a good impression to the jury.
Mm-hmm.
And today we had a really good turnout.
Right.
The courtroom was pretty much filled up.
Mm-hmm.
And just stand in solidarity.
Right. Alok, thanks a lot for coming on. And
thank you. Thank you for having me.
Hopefully, we can continue the coverage of this as the weeks go on.
Yeah, so. we'll keep you up to date.
All right. Thanks, Alok. Talk to you soon.
All right. Yeah. Take care. Bye.
That was Alok from the Justice for Awi campaign. Covering the controversial case of Awi on the Deer and. His mysterious death that had seemed to go without any impunity or, proper accountable mechanism when it comes to, policing the police, which is a serious thing. And it's been, a large issue all over the world, but, in North America especially. So we're going to go to commercial break. And when we come back, we're going to talk a bit about the miner strike happening in Sudbury. CHRY 105.5 Radio Basics.
Obsidian Theater Company. Canadian reggae lives here. Join Kerry Mullings every Monday at 10 a.m. for Rebel Vibes, the only source for Canadian reggae music. The latest news, artist interviews, and of course, Canada's best reggae. Rebel Vibes, Mondays at 10 a.m. on CHRY 105.5 FM.
Community Radio, CHRY 105.5. CHRY 105.5, Radio Basics. We're back. You know, personally, over the weekend, I watched a movie called American Dream, and it's a documentary about meat packers in Minnesota at a plant called the Hormel Factory at a company called Hormel. And basically, this was in the mid-80s, around the Reagan era, when, you know, the international economy was going through a massive restructuring, and, you know, workers were, you know, put really on the defensive, and this company, Hormel, that had, you know, a profitable year, record profits, was trying to gain concessions from their workers, trying to push their wage down from, you know, $10.60 to $8, and this sparked a huge response. There was a 9-month strike, very militant strike, you know, and people really debating about what the future of work was going to be if, you know, these workers were defeated in their quest to, not to gain, but just to keep, you know, what they've traditionally had. And, you know, it was a 9-month strike that eventually led to the company just bringing in temporary workers at a much lower cost and or a much lower wage. And, you know, there was something like thousands laid off in the Hormel plant, and it's an amazing documentary. Actually, very sad what happened, but you know, also positive to see, you know, the energetic surge that the workers put on. And the reason I bring this up is because, you know, one of the largest mining companies in the world, Vale Inco, they are, you know, engaging in similar tactics, and this happens all over the world. You know, and the clip we're going to play really demonstrates this. But so what's been happening is, you know, Vale Inco has cash on hand of $22 billion in cash assets at March 2009 when they started to enter into contract negotiations with their workers, the United Steelworkers. And, you know, they had, at that time, after-tax profits of $13 billion. They made twice as much profit in 2 years as they did, you know, 2 years before. And, you know, the executive pay is about $33 million. And these are stats I'm taking from the United Steelworkers website. And basically, you know, workers' pay is meager compared to that. They make $29 an hour, which is a very good, but you have to understand, like, these people are working, you know, thousands of feet underground in mining, which has, you know, been traditionally one of the most dangerous industries. And basically, the Vale Inco, which is a massive multinational headquartered in Toronto, but, you know, the tentacles of mining stretch worldwide from, you know, from Sudbury to Brazil to the Congo. And Canadian mining is, you know, one of the most profitable industries in the world, and also, you know, the most blood-soaked if you actually look at the history of mining and mining companies. Right, so, you know, labor accounts for one-tenth of Vale's cost, because it's a very capital-intensive industry, and labor is, you know, it's only a small fraction of what they pay, but, you know, they were trying to go after workers, and they were trying to get concessions from them, even though the company was doing amazingly well. And, you know, the Vale Inco workers have been on strike for a very long time, and I'm going to play a clip of, you know, a rally they had recently, and it's actually very positive, but very militant tone in the workers' voice in their speeches, and the international solidarity of mining companies, because they know exactly what, you know, what's happening to, you know, if what's happening to them, and they realize, you know, in terms of workers, they probably make the best wage out of most of the miners in the world. You know, what's happening to them in the concessions they're trying to take out of them, what could possibly be happening to Brazilian workers, you know, who probably don't make a fraction of what Canadian miners make. They don't have the rights. I mean, you can be laid off. You have no right to recall, no seniority in Brazil. You know, you have no access to a grievance procedure and a collective agreement. no system of arbitration, and vast majority of workers are on contract, which, you know, is very precarious, very, very stressful work. And probably the health and safety standards are super low in Brazil. So I'm going to play a clip here of a report from the Real News Network, which is a great news network. And I thank them for the clip. And, you'll get a sense of the sentiments of the workers here. So check it out.
Hi, I'm Paul Jay in Sudbury, Ontario, Canada, for the Real News Network. I'm at Vale Inco, the world's largest nickel mine. Behind me, these trucks are filled with ore, with precious metals. Vale Inco has been on strike by members of the United Steelworkers for 9 weeks. Vale Inco wants to get these trucks into that smelter. It's not a meaningful amount of ore, but they're trying to establish the legal precedent that they can break through the picket lines. But this is really part of a much bigger struggle, really a global struggle. It's clear to all these workers, if they can't coordinate their fight against Vale internationally, they're not going to have much strength. Today in Sudbury, leaders of international unions from around the world came to express their solidarity.
Today's near death, and you go.
No peace, no contract, no peace, no contract, no peace.
Vale Inco came to Sudbury and promised all kinds of things. In the 30 months that they were here, they made $4.2 billion with a B of profit. During that period of time, they extracted the wealth from our community and moved it offshore. The wealth we create in Sudbury flies right over Toronto and Ottawa and goes to bankers in Japan and in New York and in Great Britain and in Germany and, yes, in Brazil too. And the workers in Brazil get treated like chattel. When you hear their spokesman say that Vale wants a unified business model all around the globe. The unified business model they're talking about is what our friends in Brazil are struggling to change. I got an answer for them. The best business model that they should follow is the one we brought to Sudbury that gives us decent pension, decent wages, decent health and safety, and gives our members rights on the job. That's the model they ought to follow. That's the model that will bring them success. In the 1970s, while we were struggling to establish decent standards, and we had to have a strike almost every negotiations to get some dignity, they then called for the nationalization of Inco. I think it's time that we call for it again. These resources belong to us. These resources belong to us. If we get ourselves run over in Sudbury, that workers all around the world will get run over, because this is the strongest mining local in the world. We have the best collective agreement in mining in the world.
You are standing up for yourselves, for your children, for your community. But you know what? You're standing up to one of the biggest corporate bullies around the world. And so that means you're standing up for all of us. And we say congratulations.
I'm proud to convey to you a message of solidarity from 20 million workers that are represented by our affiliates worldwide.
The company's collective bargaining offer in July was about corporate greed and a race to the bottom. You were determined to say no. And today the world's metal workers stand together with you. We say no.
I'm here to express the solidarity of the Mine, Metal and Steel Workers Union of Mexico. You are not alone. You have the solidarity of all the workers and trade unionists from all over the world.
Yeah, we're back. So that was a clip of just some speeches that was going down at the Canadian or USW United Steelworkers Union rally. And they put forward some serious things. I mean, nationalization of mines was one thing. And I mean, in the current context of financial crisis, it might not be a bad idea. And, you know, if you want to check it out, check out the United Steelworkers website, and they've got a lot of information there and a lot of rallies, because this strike is still, you know, almost a year old, almost a bit more, and, you know, it's they need all the solidarity they can get. So with that, unfortunately, we're out of time. It's been a good show. I'd like to thank Alok Premji for coming on and, you know, explaining the case of Awiel Nadir. And we really, you know, we really need the community to come out and really support the case for Awi at the coroner's inquest. It's, you know, one of the last mechanisms for us to really get his case out there and, you know, have some sort of justice brought for Awi. So with that, you know, CHRY 105.5, Radio Basics, thanks a lot for tuning in. You can check out our website, www.basicsnews.ca, which, you know, has a lot of coverage of articles and different links, different things that Basics is involved in. And also, you can get a link to Radio Basics on there, where you can check out old shows, and especially this one. So I implore you guys to really check it out. And so with that, it's been a good show. I'll see you guys all next week.
Corn in the fields, listen to the rice when the wind blows across the water. King harvest is surely come. I work for the union, 'cause she's so good to me, and I'm bound to come out on top. That's where she said I should be. I will hear every word the boss may say, for he's the one who hands me down my pay. Looks like this time I'm gonna get to stay. I'm a union man now all the way.
The smell of the leaves from the magnolia trees in the meadow. Harvest is surely come.
A dry summer, then come fall, which I depend on most of all. Hey, rainmaker, can you hear the call? Please let these crops grow tall. Long enough I've been upon skid row, and it's plain to see I've no joke. My whole barn went up in smoke. Our horse Jethro, well, he went mad. I can't ever remember things being that bad. And here come a man with a paper and pen, telling us our hard times are about to end. And then they don't give us what we like.
Fields, listen to the rice when the wind blows across the road.